MechCast, Saturday, August 24th, 2013. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, there's just those weeks when the week sort of starts out and I think, man, what am I going to talk about on the next MechCast? We're going to really have nothing to talk about. And especially when it gets down to the wire, when we're sitting around waiting on Apple to do a big announcement like we are with the iPhone 5S and the new iPads coming out September, October, we should have lots of things to talk about. But I'm always worried that I'm never going to have any stories to bring you. And of course, it never ever is a problem. I'm looking through the notes this week, and we have a ton of things to talk about. Apple's been scooping up companies and employees. You got some malware to talk about, some repair programs for the iMacs, and so a little bit of international news, too. We're going to throw in some international flavor. Of course, we have updates on the 5S and 5C and some things going on in China, and the list goes on and on and on. Radio deals, TV deals, you name it, we've got it to talk about in this episode. And that's before we even get to your feedback and the things that I want to talk about in terms of, say Apple's podcast app. I have a little ranting that I did on Twitter. I got in trouble a little bit, but we'll fill you in on what that is and I'll clarify. It's hard to give your opinion in just 140 characters. So I think that was a little bit misconstrued. I want to clear the air on that. So tons of great things to get into and discuss. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, longtime supporter of the MechCast. And I love having them around because I love their software. I really do. I use all of it. Text Expander is one of my favorite applications. I don't know what I would do without it. I do. I know I'd be less efficient. I'd have less time on my hands because really can save you time, especially if you find that you have to send the same sorts of information or type out the same sorts of information over and over again. I find that anytime I notice I'm writing the same thing twice, it usually ends up in a Text Expander snippet. And one of my favorite features of Text Expander is fill-ins. And what this does is it allows you, when you're defining a snippet, to set up a part of that snippet that can be dynamic. So when that snippet expands, when you're inserting it, it will give you fill-in form or fill-in field areas that you can dynamically put information into. And I'll give you an example. For me, I have to send out a notification email when I post a show, and one of the bits of information that needs to be in there is time code. But the rest of the email is pretty standardized. So I write out the standardized part, I put in the fill-in pieces for the time codes, and then when I expand it, I can just dump in the information, and I don't have to retype that whole entire email or go try and hunt it down in my email to copy and paste it. None of that with Text Expander. It just really saves you time. And you can also do things like set up optional sections. So you can have whole sections of an expanded snippet that you either leave in or add to add expansion time. And you can take all of your snippets with you because there's Text Expander Touch and it just went version 2.0 and it has support for fill-ins. I was super excited about this, and you can sync all your snippets from your Mac to Text Expander Touch. It has Dropbox support and integration with over 160 applications. Probably your favorite application. If it deals with text, it likely has Text Expander Touch support. They have a list on their website. I'll link to it in the show notes if you want to double check and make sure. But I can't find apps on that list anymore that aren't supported. Again, if it's dealing with text, it probably has Text Expander Touch support. So if you're not using it, you really should be. You should check it out. You really need to try it. Just head over to smilesoftware.com. They have all the details over there. They also have free trials of the Mac versions. And while you're on the website, check out the other great applications, PDF Pen, Disk Label, all great stuff from Smile Software. So smilesoftware.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MechCast. You may be aware that Apple has a very large cash hoard. They have a lot of money in the bank. And very often people will ask, what is Apple doing with that money? Why don't they buy companies? And in the past, Tim Cook has commented on the fact that Apple is buying companies all of the time. We used to not hear so much about it, but we've been hearing a lot lately about all the different companies Apple's scooping up. And about a week or so ago, they scooped up a company called Matcha. It's a video discovery service, and they had an app that would let users scan multiple services, iTunes, Netflix, HBO, Hulu, to try and find shows and movies and content that would interest them. I guess Apple picked up this company, and according to reports, what appealed to Apple about the company was that they reportedly, quote unquote, found the answer. And when I was reading this report, I was like, the answer to what? And I think the answer to discovery, basically how to get people to find shows and content that they like. And I guess it's an algorithm that helps make recommendations, and it's led to proven customer engagement, according to the company. That, I guess, is all a fancy way of really saying it helps you find the stuff you want to watch, something that Apple could really use some help with, especially on the iTunes side. So for Apple, hopefully that means that when you're watching or buying content and movies from iTunes Movies, you'll be able to find that TV show and movie that's going to absolutely interest you and get you engaged. And I think there's probably going to be some social elements to this, maybe something that Apple has historically not been very good at on their own. And it was originally thought that they made the purchase for about $1 million to $1.5 million, but I was reading a report on MacNN, and they say Apple actually probably paid about 10 times more than that, about $10 million to $15 million. For the service. So we'll have to see how Apple integrates and rolls in that technology. I would imagine it would also have applications for other things, maybe like the new iTunes Radio service and the rumored TV service that Apple might be bringing out along with the television set. We're going to talk about that stuff a little bit later in the show. It was also confirmed that Apple recently bought another company called Embark. And this is a 7-person company that makes transit-related apps, and the assumption is that Apple would be using that technology to bring transit directions back into Apple Maps. If you remember, last month they also acquired another transit map company called Hopstop, so I think it's a pretty safe bet that Apple's trying to bring transit maps and directions back into their mapping application. Apple also acquired a location-based data company called Locationary. We talked a little bit about that on a past show. I think it's mostly focused around small businesses and updating the data almost in real time for those businesses. So things like hours and where the businesses are located, if the business moves or something like that, that data can be crowdsourced and updated rather quickly. And that, I think, would have more integration with Siri and those types of services along with Maps. So Apple's certainly trying to build up their services technology, and making these acquisitions is something that's going to really help them out. And they're obviously doing them quite frequently. I don't know if they were in the past or if they stepped things up more now that they're trying to bring more of these technologies in-house, but it certainly seems like they're spending some of their money wisely, because these seem like some pretty interesting and innovative companies that can really help Apple out. Apple updated iTunes this past week. iTunes 11.0.5 was released. They also released a new version to developers, 11.2 beta, and the release notes said it corrects an issue in iTunes in the cloud where some purchases may download or play unexpected items. That would have been shocking to run across. I didn't run across that bug. If you did, you probably want to go out and grab this update. I'd grab the iTunes update anyway, just stay up to date with iTunes. But that was only the only significant thing that was noted. Apple also put out a new update for Find My iPhone for iOS. It was updated to version 2.0.3 and contained bug fixes and stability improvements. But folks who jumped on the update relatively quickly ran into a little bit of an issue. It looks like Apple pushed out what was a developer beta version, at least at first, because when people were launching the application, it would mention needing to be on iOS 7 beta to actually use the app. That was quickly corrected. You can tell if you got the update because it'll have a new flat iOS 7 style icon. So the little radar icon that they use for Find My iPhone should look different after you run this update. And just a funny error on that one. It only was there for very, very briefly, it seemed like, and only a few people got impacted Find My Friends was also updated again with bug fixes. So if you use Find My iPhone, Find My Friends, you probably want to run software update on your iOS devices. And then Apple has also apparently opened up iWork in the Cloud beta for everyone. If you log into your account at iCloud.com, you should see the new icons for the iWork applications. They'll be labeled with beta and you can try them out. iMore had reported that you no longer need a developer account to see those. In the past, you had to have a developer account. They were also inviting people. A couple people got early invitations. If you never got yours, no need to wait any longer. Just log into your account and you should be good to go. Some researchers from Georgia Tech were actually able to sneak some malicious app, or a malicious app, I guess it is, into the Apple App Store. This is despite Apple's review process. As a matter of fact, to make things worse, the researchers said they were able to determine that the app was only launched and run for just a few seconds before getting the approval, and that was good for them because the way their malware worked, they called their malware Jekyll because it used a technique where they would have malicious code lying dormant in the main application code, but in bits and pieces, not assembled. So after running the application, it would wait a little while and then later assemble these dormant bits together. That would then allow it to run the malicious functions and do things like phone home for additional commands. It was disguised as a news reading application when it was submitted to Apple, and after it was activated and turned on, it could post tweets, send emails, text messages, access your address book, take pictures, and even direct Safari to malicious websites to wreak even more havoc. It also had monitoring software in there, which allowed them to tell how long Apple ran their testing process and sort of what they did. So they were monitoring and checking up to see how Apple was doing the review. After the approval process, the researchers reportedly immediately removed the application from the App Store before it was downloaded by anyone else. So they downloaded it, checked it out on their test systems to make sure it could do what it would do, and then they pulled it immediately from the App Store. So luckily, no one got hit by this one. It was purely a research thing, but they did publish a paper about the app. And an Apple spokesman came out and said Apple had already updated iOS to deal with some of the issues outlined in the paper and that they updated their app approval procedures because of the released paper. So it did have the effect of making the App Store more secure. Still a little bit scary that the researchers could get this kind of application in there. It is important to note, too, that this kind of vulnerability isn't limited to iOS. It isn't even limited to mobile software. We've had these kinds of attacks around for a long, long time. This is classic Trojan horse kind of thing. The difference here is that Apple does go through this vetting process, so you would hope that things would be a little bit more secure when you're downloading from the App Store, and I think that was sort of the point. And Apple will hopefully do a little bit better job in the future of vetting these things a little bit more closely. You know, you've got that balance between trying to get apps approved and out there quickly and in a timely fashion, but also doing the due diligence of actually vetting the app. And certainly running it for just a few seconds is probably not the best way to ensure that there's not malicious code in there. So, interesting story this week, and just once again shows that we need to be constantly on our toes, even as consumers, even with Apple saying that they've checked these applications out, making sure that we know the source of our software and what it's doing. And luckily, we've got researchers and other smart people in the tech industry kind of watching our backs. If you're the owner of one of the newer Sandy Bridge iMacs, you probably want to listen up to this next story. Apple has confirmed issues with the graphics in some Sandy Bridge era iMacs and has started up a repair program, according to 9to5Mac. iMacs manufactured between May 2011 and October 2012 are said to be included in the program, and specifically the 27-inch iMac models with 3.1 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i5 processors or 3.4 gigahertz quad-core Intel i7 models, and it would be the models with the AMD Radeon HD 9670M chips. Those chips are reportedly failing on the affected units. The display could appear distorted. It might have white or bluish vertical lines or completely turn to black. As is typical in these cases, Apple has identified the units by serial number. The last four characters of the serial number on the unit must contain a specific, be within a specific group. I'll have a listing of those in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check that out and see if you do have an affected unit. Apple has said they will replace the AMD card free of charge for up to 3 years from the computer's purchased date. And in addition, affected iMac users who've had their graphics cards already replaced and paid for it are eligible for a refund. So if you had an affected unit already, got it repaired, and Apple charged you, you might be able to get some money back. So you're probably going to want to check on this. If you think you have an affected model, you should contact AppleCare, your local Apple retail store, make a Genius Bar appointment, go in and have it checked out, or contact your Apple authorized service provider, and they should be able to help you out. We already talked a little bit about some of the companies Apple's that have been buying up. Apple has also been scooping up new employees. This week, we heard that Apple had reportedly hired fitness consultant Jay Blanick to be part of their special projects team. Blanick was a consultant for Nike and helped them develop their Fuel Band fitness monitor. Tim Cook, we know, is a fan of the Fuel Band, and he stated that the technology in the device was very interesting to him when they were talking about wearables at the D conference recently. I'm pretty sure at this point that if Apple does do some sort of wearable iWatch product, that it is going to have additional health and fitness monitoring features. So it would make sense for someone, for Apple to pick up someone like Jay Blanick. I also assume Apple would integrate the features into a companion fitness app for iOS, Mac, and possibly have syncing with iCloud. So his background does seem to be particularly appropriate for that kind of technology. So that's probably a good hire for Apple. Apple also reportedly hired a new vice president of US retail. Apple apparently hired Enrique Atenzia away from Levi Strauss, at least according to unnamed sources, and an update to Enrique's LinkedIn profile. This is according to 9to5Mac. He served at Levi as their senior vice president of Retail Americas and Global Operations. At Apple, he's going to have a little less of a title, so it must have been a pretty lucrative or at least a very interesting opportunity, because Apple is only giving him a title of director. He's basically going to be in charge for retail matters for a number of regions, including all of the West Coast of the United States. The report on his hire also mentions that Apple's Steve Cano had been promoted to vice president of retail operations earlier in the year, and I'm not sure how I missed that, because it's been reported for a while that everybody's been wondering who Apple was going to get and hire to replace John Browett, who came into play after Ron Johnson. The interesting thing is that Steve Cano reportedly has a style that's very similar to Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson is pretty much credited with bringing up Apple's retail operations to the successful levels that it's at today. And he left for JCPenney, where he didn't do quite as well and ultimately had to leave JCPenney. So Apple's retail, it's been wondering who was sort of going to lead the charge. It sounds like Steve Cano's in there, and that Atenzia is being brought in from Levi to help out with that effort as well. And then also we heard that a former Hulu executive, Pete Destad, also started at Apple this week. He will be VP of Product Marketing. Bloomberg had actually alluded to him being hired back in July, but Destad just updated his LinkedIn profile, I guess, this week. Bloomberg felt that he might be being hired to help with Apple's efforts to negotiate deals with cable and media companies. And while Apple is reportedly in ongoing talks with media companies, with a VP of Product Marketing title, it doesn't really sound like Pete is going to be helping out in the media area as much as with marketing and advertising. Maybe he will be more involved with the marketing of a potential new television product, or maybe some of Apple's TV and music products and services. We'll have to see what he's actually up to. But we have more on Apple's media efforts and sort of how it's going with the TV and cable companies later in this episode. In international news, Apple has expanded their USB charger take-back program. We talked about that on the last episode. It's now been expanded to include 30 countries, including Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, Hong Kong, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, Korea, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, and Taiwan. Also, all of the other countries that they've been in, US, China, France, Australia and the others. If you think you have a off-brand, a non-Apple charger, you can take that back into Apple and they will take care of disposing it safely. They will also allow you to buy an Apple branded charger at about half price. So if you want to take advantage of that program, just take your charger into Apple and they should take care of you. Apple's also hiring for a new store in Edinburgh, Scotland, according to reports. There's no official confirmation of the store, but the rumor has been that it will be at some location near Princess Street, which I guess is on the main route through city center. There's also no word exactly on when it will open up, but they are reportedly hiring for positions. So if you're interested in working at that Apple store, you might check it out on Apple's human resources website. We've talked a lot in the past few weeks about the iPhone 5C, specifically the case, what it's going to look like, all those interesting, shall we put it, colors that it's going to come in. You know, I'm not a big fan of the colors yet. I'm going to have to wait till I actually see them to pass judgment. But we haven't talked about how durable that new case might be. And it turns out it will be as tough as nails, or at least coins and keys. A Taiwanese blog reportedly got a hold of an iPhone 5C shell and ran it through a series of simulated real-world durability tests, at least on the video that I saw. They placed it in a bag with keys and coins and shook it around a bunch. That's a typical test that you'll see when new cases and phones come out. They also tried to scratch it with a key directly, and it came out surprisingly well. It held up very, very well. You could barely tell any damage had been done. Jason O'Grady over at the Apple Corps actually had a theory that the case might be liquid metal. If you remember, Apple has exclusive rights to liquid metal technology when it comes to consumer electronics products, but not a metal case because, of course, all the images we've been seeing seem to make it look like it has this sort of plastic case. O'Grady says it would be nitride coated. This is not to be confused with titanium nitride coating, which is actually a coating on the metal itself. This would be a different kind of coating. I guess Apple got a patent for nitride coating different metal materials, and it could be interesting because liquid metal actually can be formed and molded like plastic during manufacturing. So that would be a way it could get that kind of shape that it has. But then I guess with this nitride coating, it would add that durability and hardness to the case. I don't think that's what's happening, but it was interesting to see that piece from the Apple Corps over there. Interesting theory, but I think we're going to end up with just a plastic case that actually holds up to a lot of abuse. KG Securities analyst Ming Chai Kuo continues to prop up the reports that the low-cost iPhone would be more of a mid-range device. Kuo is putting the pricing right around $400 to $500 US without a contract subsidy. He also says it would replace the iPhone 5 in the lineup, with the iPhone 4S moving down into the current position held by the iPhone 4. To me, I'm still not buying that. As much as we're hearing it, I really think that Apple is going to want to standardize with the Lightning connector and the 4-inch display. I think they want to have that across the entire lineup. So I'm wondering why we wouldn't end up with a 16-gigabyte iPhone 5 being on the low end, the iPhone 5C models being in that mid-range, and the iPhone 5S on the high end. The key, I think, is that on that low end, how are you going to differentiate between the metal iPhone 5 case and the plastic iPhone 5C when the guts are, in essence, I think, going to be almost identical? One theory that Kelly Gaumont threw out on the recent Mac show on the British Tech Network that I was on was that maybe the iPhone 5 will be pushed down to just an 8 gig model to be that free phone. That could happen, and then you'd start with 16 gigabyte iPhone 5Cs and moving up through there. And then the iPhone 5S, we all seem to feel, is going to start at a 32 gigabyte model. We've already heard that they're going to have a 128 gigabyte version of the 5S, so you'd have 32, 64, and 128 sizes rounding out the iPhone lineup. And that seems to make the most sense to me. Ming Chai has also commented on the expected ship quantities of both devices. He said that Apple is expected to ship 8.4 million iPhone 5C units in the September quarter. For the same period, he says Apple might ship just 5.2 million of the iPhone 5S. This would be due to production yield issues related to that fingerprint sensor. That's something we've heard Apple is struggling with and could push down at least initial supplies and availability of the iPhone 5S, but unlike some others, he doesn't think that the iPhone 5C will become Apple's most popular phone model. He sees production ramping up quickly, with iPhone 5S shipments climbing to about 28 million units in a three-month span, with 5C shipments raising to about 18.7 million units in that same period. So Apple selling more iPhone 5S's than 5C's, at least according to Ming-Chi Kuo. As for the latest on the iPhone 5S, the home button, it's said now, is going to be largely the same, even with the fingerprint sensor. Ming-Chi Kuo had commented that it might be a convex, rounded, sort of stick-out button. I really didn't buy that rumor, and the latest ones seemed to make a lot more sense to me. There was also this speculation that Apple might get rid of the little square icon on the home button. I think that's something that is pretty much iconic of the iPhone, and I can't imagine them removing it. So that is reported to stay as well. And we've also got some more updates on that gold color. It looks like that is happening, but it is going to be more of that champagne kind of color. So not a bright gold, but more of a muted gold with the white. It'll be interesting to see how popular that becomes or how good it looks, but Apple will have three different colors now in the iPhone 5S lineup: the black and slate, the white and silver, and the white and gold. It'll be interesting also to find out what the official color is called, if it's called champagne, if it's called gold, or if Apple has some other marketing term for it. At this point, we're pretty much guaranteed and know it's been confirmed that Apple will announce the iPhone 5S and the 5C at an event on September 10th. That got the seal of approval, yep, from Jim Dalrymple, and was sourced by all of the major sources as being the date when Apple will give us an announcement. But we haven't really known when Apple will actually start shipping the units. This week, there were rumors out of Japan suggesting that the launch date for the devices would be September 20th. So about 10 days after the announcement, you'll be able to walk into your local favorite Apple store and pick up a new device. That is, of course, if you don't pre-order it. I would assume they're going to have pre-orders right after either the day of or within a few days of the September 10th announcement. So get your checkbooks, credit cards, your bank accounts, your cash ready, because the iPhones are coming. A market that Apple could have potential growth in, and many see as a potential growth opportunity for Apple, is China. And we've known for many years that Apple has been working hard to try and land a contract with China's largest mobile carrier, China Mobile. Recently, China Mobile has also reported that they've been talking with Apple, that both parties are really, quote-unquote, keen to get a deal done. And most people think that Apple and China Mobile could have a deal in place by the end of this year. China Mobile is also reporting that they're making really good progress on rolling out their TD LTE network. That's a network that could be supported by an iPhone. And China Mobile's 700 million subscribers would give Apple a nice new potential customer base, especially for the iPhone 5C. It looks like this device that's primed for the China market and primed to attract new customers in the region. So it would reportedly support that new China Mobile TD LTE network. And Katie Huberty over at Morgan Stanley took a look at a recent survey done by AlphaWise, and it showed that if Apple could strike a deal with China Mobile and offered a $400 price point phone, they could see their market share in China rise by almost 20%, 19.3%. So that's a pretty big incentive to get the deal done. And if the predictions are accurate, it could mean that the iPhone would become the best selling smartphone in China. As a matter of fact, UBS analysts also seem to think that the iPhone 5C could end up being a big deal in China, and they raised their price target on Apple shares from $500 to $560. There's also been some debate going on recently about that gold color and how well it might appeal to a Chinese market. This would be on the iPhone 5S. The premium phone could appeal to customers in the Chinese market, according to a number of reports I've been reading. I actually floated the idea after I received an email from a listener from Taiwan who said that the gold color would be really popular there, and also said that it would probably be really popular in the China market. Apparently, Fortune's Philip Elmer DeWitt also has heard the theory, and he's not buying it. I hope he didn't hear it from me, but he's saying there's no evidence to support the fact that Chinese consumers like the gold color any more than any other color. And as a matter of fact, he pointed to a DuPont Chinese car color preference study from 2011 to actually prove his point. He said that China consumers don't really like gold color cars any more than U.S. consumers. I personally think that the color choice of a car versus the color choice of a consumer product is something that really can't be compared. These days, I think in many respects, you can say that your cell phone is almost a fashion accessory, and gold is a very popular color in terms of accessories. So in that light, I think it's more likely that it is going to appeal to certain consumers. And as a matter of fact, for proof, I'm going to say Samsung has already beat Apple to the punch, and they announced the Galaxy Golden. So we know that if Samsung is already preemptively copying something that Apple might do, then it's very likely that Apple's going to do it, and there must be some sort of appeal. I really can't make this stuff up. They put out a phone called the Galaxy Golden, or announced it this week. It's an Android flip phone. It features two 3.7-inch AMOLED displays with a 1.7 gigahertz dual-core processor, an 8-megapixel camera, a 1.9-megapixel front-facing camera, LTE support, and a 1,820 milliamp hour battery. It runs Android 4.2 Jelly Bean, and of course is available in a champagne gold color. So there you go. Gold phones are coming, and we're going to get a lot of them. And do they appeal to Chinese consumers more than U.S. consumers? I guess we're about to find out. As for when China might see the new iPhone, it might be a little bit later than consumers in other parts of the world. China's First Financial Daily is reporting that the new phones will need to clear the verification process that's required by China's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, and that can take some time after the announcement. Because of that, they're actually predicting that the iPhone 5S and 5C will start showing up in China around November 28th. And while the iPhones are poised to do very well in China and see booming sales, it would seem that the iPad has recently been struggling a little bit. This is according to an IDC report. They say that iPad market share in China fell in the second quarter from 50% of China's tablet market to just 28%. During that same period, Samsung's share rose 11% and Lenovo 8%. Apple is also losing tablet share to the rising crowd of what's called white box Android tablets. We talked about that a little bit. These are just different generic brand tablets from manufacturers that have different labels. They're all the same tablet, but sold by a bunch of different kinds of manufacturers. They're really cheap, and those are on the rise in the region also, which is causing the numbers for Apple to go down a bit. Now, the numbers, I think, don't really give us a full picture of what's going on, because what we know is that overall tablet sales are rising at a dramatic rate everywhere, including China. So there's many more tablets being sold. My assumption is that rise is happening very, very rapidly. And so while Apple might be getting a smaller piece of the pie at this point, that size of that pie is growing tremendously. So in overall sales, in terms of profits and things like that, it's likely not having as big of an impact, but we are seeing the market getting split up a little bit more, and Apple's dominant share is going to be getting smaller in various regions. And I think that was pretty much to be expected as we have more and more tablets and more competition coming online. What do you think about the theory that Apple may stagger the release of iOS 7 based on different versions, that they will release the iPhone, iPod Touch versions along with the release of the new iPhone 5S and 5C models, and then follow up with the iPad version, making that available when they release new iPads, specifically those new Retina-based iPad minis that we're expected to get in October. Sounds a little crazy. I don't know why Apple would do that, but Mark Gurman over at 9to5 Mac is claiming that's exactly what they plan to do, that the iPhone version is on track to go Gold Master in time for the iPhone 5S, 5C launch, and that the iPad version of iOS 7 is actually running behind. He says that many developers have noted that the iOS 7 builds for iPad feel unstable and more unreliable compared to the iPhone versions, and that part of the reason for the delay is that iOS 7 for iPad betas came out a few weeks after the iPhone version, so developers haven't had as much time with them, haven't been working on them as much. The claim is that this would give Apple more time with the iPad versions, and they're considering delaying the release so that new iPhones come out in September with iOS 7 for iPhone, and then they will wait on the new iPad hardware, expected to be late September, early October, and then ship a point release version, iOS 7.0.1, along with the refreshed iPads. It sounds plausible to me. Initially, I thought it was kind of unlikely, but then I had to go back and remember Kelly Gaumont again reminded me that Apple has done this in the past where they released the iPhone version and the iPad versions separately. They did it back in iOS 5. And it certainly would give them a little more time to optimize the iPad version. It would be unfortunate because I would hope that iOS 7 would get released for all devices at the same time. But I think I'd opt and rather have Apple have a more stable, reliable version ready to go, something that's polished and done. And it would make sense to release it alongside brand new models of the iPad. So I think it could happen. I'm hoping it doesn't happen, but it is likely. I think Tim Cook would be the first to tell you that we are moving into this post-PC era. What he might not mention is that that post-PC era is not necessarily good for sales of desktops and notebooks. Gene Munster of Piper Jaffray looked at the latest U.S. domestic Mac sales numbers from the NPD group, and guess what? Well, Apple is following the overall PC trend of declining desktop and notebook sales. Luckily for Apple, it seems to be a little bit of a slower slide than their competitors, and the sales themselves, at least in part, are going right into Apple's own pockets because of the iPad business. This was something that, you know, I think Apple was fully aware of when they started making iPads. But for the September quarter, Munster thinks that Mac sales will be down about 5%. Year over year, calculating out the numbers, that means that Apple will sell approximately 4.65 million Macs for the quarter. That would be down from the 4.9 million they sold in the same period last year. It's probably not so bad for Apple, though. You know, Tim Cook said years ago that the tablet sales would be overtaking PC sales, and Apple really knew this was coming. The bonus is that Apple's iPhone and iPad sales are on the rise. They're booming, at least in terms of revenue, and they represent a much larger part of Apple's overall revenue versus Mac sales. So it's not going to be as big a hit. Macs are still important, right? But they will be and are expected to be taking a smaller role in Apple's overall business. We've been seeing this trend for years. I don't think it's anything really shocking. Overall, also, the PC industry sales are just declining. Apple's doing it at a slower rate, which is good for them. And it's likely going to be a benefit to Apple that they're selling more tablets, and that what they're losing sales to is their own tablets because they have the halo effect. Those folks who are buying iPads, they're going to tend to buy other Apple products, iPhones, iPods, and Macs in the future. So if they're not buying Macs now, they're more likely to become a longer-term Apple customer. And that's not even factoring in all the additional services and products that Apple gets to upsell people on, things like iTunes Music and movies and TV shows and iCloud services. So overall, it's a good thing for Apple's bottom line. And, you know, I think more and more people are just, because of tablets and being in the post-PC era, we're pushing off purchases of new desktops and new notebooks and things like that. We're still going to buy them. We're just not going to be buying as many as we did in the past. Now, if you really want to hone in on a piece of Apple's business that's in serious decline and has been in serious decline for a while, you need to look no further than the iPod. That same NPD data showed that domestic sales of Apple's portable music players are down 41% year over year. This is for the month of July. And Munster thinks that in the September quarter, year over year, sales for iPod will be down 20%. Again, not a surprising statistic as more people turn to their iPhones to be their media playing devices, their portable media playing devices, and also replace iPods with iPads. Things like the iPad Mini make a perfect compromise between music player device, media device, and I think a lot of people are opting for that versus going with a new iPod Touch. One thing that could help with the Mac sales, though, would be updated MacBook Pros and iMacs, and at least some sources think that we might see updated Haswell models of both the MacBook Pros and iMacs in the next couple weeks. For the iMacs, what's happening right now is we're seeing especially custom configurations being discounted at many retailers, and reportedly some of the channel supplies are starting to slow down. So iMacs are being shipped out at lower rates from the manufacturing. That's typically a sign that Apple's getting ready to put new models into the channel. Some speculate that updated Haswell iMacs will be coming as soon as the end of this month. Sources in the supply chain from Taiwanese manufacturers have reportedly begun also shipping components for new MacBook Pros. A lot of people have been wondering since the release of the Haswell MacBook Airs when we're going to get an update to the MacBook Pros. Apple could unveil a new MacBook Pro along with the iPhones at the September 10th event, although personally I think that's going to be mostly about the iPhone. Maybe they could do a refresh or an update in the background, although with a Haswell model, it seems like Apple could have enough to talk about. In addition to the new processor that would be expected in the MacBook Pros, it's also expected that they would have the new Intel Iris Pro 5200 GPUs. Those are meant to compete with some of the dedicated GPUs from AMD and NVIDIA, but bring the benefits of power and longer battery life, something that Apple has been really focusing on, especially with those updated Haswell MacBook Airs. It's expected that battery life would be a big feature. Improved battery life and significantly improved battery life would be a big feature of updated MacBook Pros. So those theories seem pretty good, and I expect Apple would want to, again, have new iMacs and MacBook Pros in channel, ready to go, ready to sell for the holiday buying season. But again, here we are, just one more thing that we're going to have to lust after. The fact that Apple has put everything in the back half of the year is just crazy to me. I think consumers are going to have to make some hard choices about where they're going to spend their dollar, where in the past, when it was spread out, you might buy multiple Apple products in a single year. It's going to be hard for a lot of people to spend all of this cash at once. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects the numbers when we start getting quarterly sales results for those holiday quarters. And Apple has also been reportedly running some ads for the new Mac Pros in the movie theaters. I think those have also now shown up online on YouTube and places like that if you want to check it out. It's a pretty sort of impactful. It's definitely got that movie feel, movie trailer feel to it, that the segment that they're running. But they are teasing that the new MacBook Pros would be available for a fall 2013 release. They're not giving a hard date, but those could come out along with new MacBook Pros and new updated iMacs all at the same time, everything coming. And I think at this point, Rene Ritchie is spot on with what he's saying over at iMore, which is a nice nod to Game of Thrones. Fall is coming. Even though the service will be free, and even though it won't be here for another month or so, it looks like iTunes Radio is already proving to be pretty lucrative for Apple. At least they are attracting some pretty high-profile advertisers for the service. This is according to Ad Age. Apple has already lined up companies like McDonald's, Nissan, Pepsi, and Procter & Gamble to run spots on their new service. iTunes Radio is going to offer a Pandora-like streaming service for free inside your music app, both on your devices and on your Mac, running iOS 7 and the newer versions of iTunes. It lets you create stations based on an artist or song preference, and then you can get streaming music from similar artists all for free. And within the service, you'll have the ability to one-tap purchase songs and music from iTunes, so Apple will also generate revenue that way. It's really about music discovery. The service is going to insert audio or video ads, and Apple is reportedly striking deals in the tens of millions, or in the millions to tens of million dollar range. So they're signing up some pretty significant big contracts. iTunes Radio listeners will reportedly hear one audio ad about every 15 minutes and see a video ad each hour while using the service. And some of the partners are also being offered the opportunity, I'm assuming for a lot more money, to create sponsored stations, which actually would have fewer and I would imagine exclusive ads in them. If you're an iTunes Match subscriber, though, you will be able to get to use the service completely ad-free. So if you want to pay your $25 a year, you can get the service without ads. If you want it for free, you get the ads. But so far, it sounds like it's going to be pretty minimal in terms of the ad exposure. And I think most people are going to be pretty open to just having and using the free service. What's going to be really interesting is to see how this impacts or changes Pandora's service. We already did see this week that Pandora has removed the 40-hour streaming limit, I guess, on their free service. So now you can unlimitedly stream audio on Pandora with a free account. I guess something you couldn't do in the past. I've used Pandora for a long time and never run into the limit, so I don't think it was much of an issue before, but now they supposedly removed that restriction, and some of the speculation is that's because iTunes Radio is coming. macOS 10 Mavericks is one step closer to its impending release. Apple released macOS 10 Mavericks developer preview version 6, the sixth iteration of macOS 10 Mavericks. There was no change log posted, so Apple really isn't saying what's in it at this point. It did bring them, though, back online with the two-week release cycle that had been disrupted by the developer site outage that Apple ran into. They had been releasing new updates or new developer previews about every 2 weeks. They're back on that cycle. 2 weeks ago, they released the fifth developer preview, which actually brought iBooks functionality to Mavericks. That was something that was announced at WWDC, but hadn't been in the builds until the fifth beta. So that's on track. We should be getting Mavericks sometime this fall. And then finally, Apple is continuing to pursue TV deals, at least according to the latest rumors from Mac Rumors and a new business publication called Quartz. The Quartz publication, I guess, is staffed by some former Wall Street Journal reporters, and they're reporting that Apple is involved in high-level negotiations with television content providers like ESPN, HBO, and Viacom, and they're talking to them about providing programming through apps instead of channels. The report claims that it is not really shocking because the TV industry is actually in talks with just about everybody, but the gist is that Apple wants to provide a paid TV service at some point, hopefully launching in conjunction with a actual television product, not just the Apple TV set-top box. Basically, Apple would become a sort of cable provider, but delivering their shows over iCloud internet-style service versus, you know, actual cable network. Intel, Sony, and Google are also looking to have similar deals, and so far it sounds like the TV providers are offering terms similar to those that they would be providing to traditional cable companies. I would assume that those terms are not actually the terms that Apple is looking for, and because they likely wouldn't really revolutionize the current television system, which is something that I think Apple is setting out to do. So that's probably part of the reason why it's been a long delay, and we've just been hearing rumors that these talks going back and forth and not getting really far. Apple already reportedly has a deal in place with the CW to bring content, although we haven't seen that show up on the Apple TV. I don't know if that would be part of this service that they would be working on. I think they could actually probably launch a service with just a few key providers, especially if they were these providers, folks like HBO, ESPN, or Viacom. Viacom does Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, and MTV. Those are some pretty popular products and channels that would be in there. And there's also been these reports that the NFL has been talking to Google about possibly bringing NFL Sunday Ticket to this kind of streaming service. That would be massively popular if Apple could land something like that with the NFL. That could be enough top-tier content for them to launch a streaming service, grow some momentum, and then they could start to attract other players as they saw how well folks like HBO, ESPN, and Viacom, NFL were doing on Apple's platform. It's a strategy that's worked really well for them in the past. If you remember when they launched iTunes, the music wasn't all there. When they launched Apple TV, they didn't have a bunch of content. We've seen a lot of new content deals come online with the Apple TV, and the Apple TV is rising in popularity. And I think as that happens, more companies, more content providers are paying attention to what Apple's doing and probably want to get in on a piece of that action. So this sounds great, but I'm not getting too excited yet. Apple and Viacom aren't commenting so far, and representatives from HBO and ESPN, when they were asked about these talks, basically denied that they were even happening. I'm not buying that. I think they are going on. I think they just don't want to tip their hands and let anybody know sort of what's going on, at least not until the deals are fully done. And I think we're a long way off from that, maybe sometime in 2014, but I'm guessing it would be toward the end of 2014. I'm not holding my breath for an Apple TV service or an Apple branded television anytime soon. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. On last week's show, we talked a little bit about the Carl Icahn deal, and he's reportedly going to go this week and talk with Tim Cook about doing stock buybacks. And I had mentioned that buybacks was a big thing. He had made Icahn had made an investment in Apple. He had raised his position by like $1 billion in the company, and that helped Apple's stock price, brought it back up. And there's been these rumors that Apple may buy back more stock than they had initially planned. What I didn't understand, because I'm not a financial guy, is what does a buyback mean? And so I asked you if you could provide any insight for us, and actually Bill responded.
Hey Adam, this is Bill, longtime listener and fan of the show. Just wanted to offer a comment. You mentioned during the MacCast this week that Carl Icahn, and yeah, I don't know if it's Icahn or Icahn, but I always say Icahn, had caused a jump in the stock price because he indicated he'd bought a large stake in the company, about $1 billion. The second part of that is what you asked for some comment on, which is that he was pushing Apple to increase the buyback program, and you were wanting to explain why my buying back shares would be more valuable or cause the shares to be more valuable. So here's a quick explanation. I'll break it down into two parts. The first part is just the fundamentals, and then second part applies that. So the fundamentals are that the company reports earnings each quarter, and one of the ways that shares are valued is based on the earnings of the overall company. So a quick example to illustrate, and obviously I'm going to just use some easy numbers. So let's just say you have a public company that reports $100 in earnings for a given quarter, and there happens to be 100 shares outstanding. What people then end up doing is determining what the value of the company's earnings is on a per share basis. And you do that very simply by taking the earnings and dividing it by the number of shares to give you earnings per share. So you'd have $100 in earnings divided by 100 shares gives you $1 per share. So secondly, let's apply that to what we're talking about in terms of share buybacks. So let's say you have that same company that's earned $100 during the quarter, but now you've bought back 50 of the shares. What you would then do is take that $100 of earnings and it's divided between those 50 shares, which would mean you'd have $2 per share of earnings, or in Wall Street parlance, you'd have $2 earnings per share. Now, when an individual is determining what stock to buy, if they're using a fundamental valuation basis, one of the things they would look at is what are the earnings per share, so that you can compare one company against another and determine how much value there is being created by the company based on their earnings per share. Obviously, a company that's earning $2 per share would have a share that's more valuable than a company that's earning $1 per share. So that's how a buyback would actually increase the value of the shares of the company. I'll touch on two other quick things as well. One is perception. Fundamentals is not the only thing that drives share price, and that's a huge part of what happened this past week is the perception of the stock being undervalued was increased because somebody who's an activist investor actually came out on that publicly, Carl Icahn tweeting about it. And obviously his take on the buybacks is the secondary part of what drove that. The last thing I'll comment on is you also mentioned dividends, and that works very much in the same way. If you have the same amount of dividends being distributed by the company, but there's fewer shares, the amount of dividend per share is going to go up. The alternative is if the company wants to keep the amount of dividend per share the same, the company can use less money to do that, and that's, I think, what you mentioned during the MacCast. Either way, hope the explanation is helpful for you. Keep up the great work. Love the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, Bill, that was awesome. That was a great explanation and helped me completely understand it. I think it completely makes sense, and I really appreciate you sending in that feedback because it puts it into plain language for those of us who don't live and breathe the stock market. So thanks again. If you're not visiting the MacCast forum, I know I mentioned it at the end of every episode, but if you haven't gone and checked it out, I think you're really missing out on a great part of our community. I know that I am completely guilty of not visiting as often as I should. And so what I'm saying is just as much for me as it is for you. We have some very great, smart, active members over there, and they provide a lot of really good advice and additional information on the various episodes. And I was in there this week, and that's what happened. John Foster from No Tech TV he's one of those smart members who's in there. He's posting stuff, he's answering questions, and he has this really great post on our more RAM discussion that we've been having over the last few episodes. And I mentioned that I make this absolute statement about RAM that, you know, the biggest upgrade that you can do, the best upgrade you can do for your Mac is to put in more RAM. And I said that a couple shows back, and a couple people have called me out, rightly so, in email and asked me to clarify a little bit, explain, and, you know, debate that versus maybe some of the other kinds of upgrades that you want to do. And John made some great points in his post that I wanted to bring up in the show in case you haven't checked it out, but you really should go over to the forum, and I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com, or just head to forum.maccast.com, free to sign up and participate. But what John points out is that, you know, that idea of putting in more RAM, when you buy a machine, you know, I say get as much RAM as you possibly can, and why would you do that, I guess, is the question, right? And John addresses that, is it makes your system slightly more future-proof, and I totally agree with that. And the other thing is, and this is a very valid point, is that you can double or max out the RAM in that system that you're buying, and it typically doesn't add a lot more to the base cost. It might add a couple $100, a few $100 to the base price, but adding that RAM, especially if you're buying it from Apple, it doesn't change the shipping costs that you're paying. It doesn't affect installation or configuration. Again, assuming you're having Apple build it into the system when you order it and you're not installing it yourself, it doesn't add anything beyond the cost of the RAM upgrade itself. So you might as well go for the additional RAM if you can afford it. Another thing that he points out in that post is that with an older system, because a lot of times when we're talking about adding RAM or upgrading a system, we're talking about upgrading an older system to kind of get some additional use or more longevity out of that system. There is a limit on RAM and how much RAM you can put into an older system, but oftentimes that limit that Apple says it has might not be the limit. And that's because when Apple sets their limits on RAM, they often base it on what's available at the time the machine was released or made. So it could be that when they put the Mac out, there were only, say, 2 gigabyte sticks available for RAM, and now there's 4 gigabyte sticks available. So your RAM threshold, the amount you might be able to put in there, might actually be higher. So you're going to want to check with the RAM vendors to see if the system you have will actually take more. I also added to that thread, because a great resource for finding out the capabilities and what you can do with your system is the software Mac Tracker. You can go to MacTracker.ca, download a free app, and it has all the specifications on every product Apple has ever made. So you can go in there, you can look up your Mac, and they have this great feature. It'll show you the amount of RAM, or the maximum amount of RAM Apple says your system will take, but they will also point out the actual amount of RAM that you can put in your system. So that can be a helpful tool in determining, you know, how much RAM can I put in and how much can I upgrade. And I already talked about these absolute rules that I sort of set out, you know, that more RAM will always make everything go faster or make your machine last longer. And that's not 100% the case. You know, there are eventually bottlenecks that you're going to hit beyond just the RAM. Your CPU, as John points out in his piece, can only go so fast. You are going to hit CPU limits in certain situations. Hard drives can also be a bottleneck, especially if you're using spinning drives and almost, if they're almost full, if you're really filling up your drive to the maximum, that can have a significant impact on performance. I tend to try and leave about a 15%, what I call overhead or free available space on all of my, on my main system hard drive, just so that I have that sort of wiggle room. And that could be an even bigger factor if you have SSD and flash drives. You know, they can be a solution to provide more speed, more performance, and extend the life of your system, but they also tend to be smaller, which means I think that a lot of people tend to run them closer to being 100% full. So if your drive is completely full, you're not going to be able to take advantage of virtualized RAM and some of the other features that are built into your system. And not all applications are optimized to take full advantage of all the RAM you have in your system. So you could throw in RAM and not every app is going to see the benefit of that additional RAM. And that's a very valid point and something worth thinking about. And another even more valid point, I think, is that not all apps need all the RAM that you have. Your text editor, for example, is likely not going to go a lot faster or be that vastly improved by putting in more RAM. John points out in his piece, and I thought this was very clever and smart, is that, you know, typing faster, it's not going to make you type faster. So in that case, if you know, your word processing isn't going as fast as you like, you might be better served by learning to become a better typer. That's very, very true. And then, you know, adding RAM can be a great boost to your system. It can allow you to run more applications. It can allow you to do more things. But by that same token, doing those things are also kinds of behaviors that can cause your system to, again, slow down and start to not perform as well, right? We getting RAM and getting higher performance can allow us to be lazier with how we use our systems and lead to bad habits that affect performance. It can be easier sometimes and even cheaper than buying more RAM to just shut stuff down when you're not using it. I mean, look over at your dock. How many apps do you have running? How many little dots do you have sitting there? And do you really need all of those things running right now, active and going on? Same thing for your browser. How many of us have a million freaking tabs open? Look at how many tabs are running across there. How many of those sites are sitting there in the background running ads, running flash in the background for things that you're not even looking at? Those things are stealing precious resources from that Word document that you're working on. So that other thing that you're doing could be being impacted by your browser running in the background with a million tabs open. Why not shut down the tabs, or better yet, shut down the browser that you're not using? OS X Mavericks, as a matter of fact, is going to have technologies in it specifically designed to address these bad working habits. They have technologies like AppNap and Safari Power Saver, compressed memory, the timer coalescing. But why wait for Mavericks to add that kind of functionality when on your Mac today, you could just shut down stuff? And especially if you have an older Mac, you might not be able to run Mavericks. So a better way to do it, rather than spending more money to solve the problem and throwing technology at it, is just change your sorts of working habits. And that's a very valid point. I know I'm guilty of that all the time. I look over, systems running slow, and I've got, you know, 10 applications open, and you can only really work on so many applications at once. It's one of the great things about iOS devices, running one app at a time, right? You're putting the power in the app that you're working with, and that's what those Mavericks technologies are designed to take advantage of. But you can do that manually. You don't need new technology to take advantage of that. And then the last thing I want to comment on, this wasn't something that was brought up in John's thing, but I had talked in the last episode about how to determine when you might need more memory. And I fell back on something called page ins and page outs. Basically, when you max out your RAM, at some point, your system is going to flop over. It's going to move into virtual memory, and it's going to have to take information and stuff that's in memory that it can't fit and move that out to your disk. It actually writes out to your hard drive. And that process is really expensive. It can really slow down your system. So you can go into Activity Monitor. You can look at your RAM. And if you're seeing a lot of page outs, that's typically a sign that you probably want to put in more physical RAM if you can do that. And somebody wrote me to point out that, you know, that could be a little bit of an old rule, because with spindle hard drives, spindle-based hard drives, that can be an issue. But if you have flash drives or SSD storage, if you're running a MacBook Air, that operation might not be that expensive. So maybe a better upgrade would be to get a solid state storage drive. It's faster. It can move the memory back and forth. What I don't know is I don't know specifically how that compares, how that writing out compares to buying more RAM. My gut instinct tells me that buying more RAM is still the more efficient way to deal with high page outs, and that an SSD drive, you're still writing out to the disk. You're going to have additional disk writes, so that could put additional wear and tear on your SSD drive. I really don't know. I need to look into it a little bit deeper. If you happen to know, if you've done the research on this and want to share that information with us, let us know. But I'm going to be looking at it, into it a little bit deeper. But, you know, at least if you're writing RAM out to flash storage, the other thing that could come into play is, again, SSDs tend to be smaller. They might be fuller. You're now writing out RAM and eating up and filling up more of your drive. So that could come back and, again, continue to affect performance. So I think on a dollar per dollar value basis, I still think that adding more RAM is still a really good upgrade. If you can afford to move from a traditional spinning hard drive to an SSD, then I think that's a great upgrade as well. It's a nice way to bring new life to your old system, but I just don't think it's as cost effective. Even though prices on SSD drives have come down, I think you're going to end up sacrificing storage capacity and paying a per gigabyte premium. I know I've been lusting after and looking at maybe upgrading my hard drive and my MacBook Pro to an SSD, but at the end of the day, I still just can't justify the additional cost. And, you know, in buying new machines, we're really not going to have a choice. I think Apple's moving to all solid state. So in the future, the decision's going to be made for me. But for now, I'm sticking with spindle drives and just maxing out my RAM. That's how I get the most longevity out of my system. I doubt you find it surprising that I am pretty passionate about podcasts and podcasting. And by the same token, I am pretty critical about my podcast applications, the things that I use for listening to podcasts on my devices. And I think it's also no secret that a lot of people don't like Apple's podcast app all that much. And I would consider myself in that camp. And I had last week or over the past couple of weeks, I've had a number of people who have emailed me about some issues and troubles they've been having with Apple's podcast app. And I guess at the end of the day, I just got frustrated and discovered something you probably don't want to do, which is vent about Apple's podcast app on Twitter. And that's exactly what I did. I think I specifically called it poop, using the little poop emoji icon. Yeah, I did that. But 140 characters is probably not a great, well, it's a great way to start a debate, but it's hardly a place to have any kind of meaningful discourse on a topic. So I wanted to bring that conversation to the MacCast, because what I learned actually after sending that tweet was that the camp seems to be pretty evenly split, and a lot of you really like Apple's podcast app, and that's fine. I have really no problem with that. I was just sharing my very slanted, very one-sided opinion in 140 characters. And so I wanted to clarify my unique position on the topic. And for a long time, I've done the extra work that it takes to put out a enhanced podcast. Most of you know that. You probably know that. And I support Apple's enhanced AAC features. And the tool I use to produce my podcast is an Apple tool. It's GarageBand. And it takes advantage and allows me to put in those features. And you and I love those extra features. The chapter markers with titles, the hyperlinks, the changing album artwork. They really, I think, enhance the overall listening experience. I think it's great for podcasts. I am very appreciative for Apple in making those features available. The problem and the frustration that I was venting on Twitter was that Apple has been doing a horrible job lately supporting their own format and their own apps. And this is something that Apple classically does. They put out great technologies. They throw stuff forward. They get us hooked on it. They get us using it. And then they go and completely abandon the entire thing, or what feels like abandon is abandoning the entire thing. And then when you try and reach out, you try and talk to them about it, you try and send email to feedback, support@apple.com, it seems like no one's listening. It seems like your cries fall on deaf ears. So we say, we love this stuff, we want you to support it. They take features away and they don't support it. iTunes 11, for example, has almost completely removed all support for enhanced podcasts, especially in the mini player. It still has chapters. You still have the chapter menu bar when you're playing an episode in iTunes. And when you drop that down, the little artwork thumbnails are there, but that is it. Hyperlinks, gone. You can't find them anywhere. In the mini player, changing album art doesn't work. It stays exactly the same. It's just the main album art. And it's just, it's really frustrating as someone who puts in that extra time and effort to make that happen, to put those features in there, to not have it supported by the company that makes it possible is just really frustrating. The podcast app itself, it actually has become better, but there's still some very big, significant bugs that makes it that make it hard for me to really recommend it as an application, especially for enhanced AAC playback. The redesign did bring back the chapter list, but there is a bug and it's not showing the chapter titles. I've reported this to Apple for a year now, I think. I don't know how long it's been since it hasn't been supported in there, but it doesn't do it. It also doesn't have the artwork thumbnails in the chapter list, something I'd like to see them bring back. The links are in there and they work, and the artwork does change on the now playing screen, so I'm very happy for that. But the really big issue is that, and what I was dealing with this week, was there were a number of people emailing me to say that the AAC files were actually crashing the podcast app, and especially on older devices. And I've dealt with this for a while, and I had no idea why, because I do everything to Apple's specifications. I produce the AAC files in Apple's app, and they seem to play fine in every other third-party podcast application. So this was specifically an Apple issue. And after my rant, Rob Walsh from Today in iPhone actually emailed me to explain, and he works at Libsyn, and they've worked with their engineers. Libsyn is a company that supports podcasts. They do podcast distribution and hosting of audio files and things like that. Awesome company. I love Libsyn. And he said that their engineers discovered that if your chapter album art is larger than 300 by 300 pixels or bigger than 200 kilobits per second, then that is what is causing these issues. And that's fine and dandy, and I can change my workflow, but the thing is that Apple's current podcast spec calls for artwork that is 1400 by 1400 pixels, at least for the main album art. And the reason for that is to support Retina devices. You need to have these high resolution files so that they look good on Retina displays. And we know that Apple's moving everything to Retina. So I want my stuff to look the best it possibly can on your devices. And so I was fully in line with doing 1400 by 1400 pixels. But I guess that works for the main artwork, but in the chapter artwork, they want us to use the lower res, the smaller files. And to me, that just looks, that's dumb. It's going to look horrible. And why Apple wouldn't support Retina for podcasts in their own podcast app is just completely frustrating. So, of course, I've reported all this to Apple and there's no response, no nothing. There doesn't seem to be any changes. And so I'm getting frustrated. Can you tell? You probably can tell in this rant. They're the creators of the format. They have podcasts as a huge part of their ecosystem. And at a certain point, it feels to me like they just don't care. They just don't seem to want to do anything about it. And so I have a hard time telling people or recommending to people that they use Apple's podcast app. Apple's podcast app also doesn't easily support protected feeds, which is a big deal for me with the member show. You can't go in there, and you can't really get in there and easily add a feed URL manually. You actually can. A lot of people don't know this. There's a trick. If you put a podcast feed URL in the search box inside Apple's podcast app, it will manually subscribe you to that feed. There's also a trick to manually subscribe to a protected feed. But you have to put your username and password in the URL, and that's not good, security and all that other stuff. It's not a great app, in my opinion. And Apple should really be looking to create the best podcast app they possibly can, and it just doesn't feel like they are. And again, my biggest frustration, my unique position, is that they're not supporting the enhanced AAC podcast format in a way I think that they should. And there's lots of other great third-party apps that are alternatives that are doing an excellent job. Downcast is my personal favorite. They don't support every enhanced podcast feature, and I wish they were doing a little bit better job too. But actually, when you go in and you send them feedback and you mention things to them, they respond and they actually try to make the app better. There's Instacast. There's Pocket Cast, which I just started playing around with and is really nice. There's Podcaster. And all of these things have a lot more finite control. They allow you to do more things with your podcasts. And I think they are all better apps than Apple's podcast app. Now, again, I'm not saying don't use Apple's podcast app. If you use it and you find it works for you, that's really great. And that was the problem with the Twitter rant, is it sort of started this debate. And I think a lot of people felt I was attacking their podcast app. That's not what I'm doing. I'm just trying to say I don't think Apple does the best job. And if you're looking for the best podcast app to listen to the MacCast on right now, in my opinion, Apple's app isn't it. So I hope that clarifies things. And I'm open and welcome to hear your feedback on the topic. I encourage it, as a matter of fact. And so if you want to email in, or actually better yet, send an audio comment in defending Apple's podcast app, please send it along, macast@gmail.com. Received this next audio comment, I think, a couple weeks ago, and I had not had a chance to address it. And one of the reasons is that, I just don't know what to tell you on this question, because I'm not a car guy, and this is a car related question. So I thought the best thing to do would be to maybe throw this out to the community. I'm going to give you some feedback on sort of how I manage and handle this this problem at the moment. But here's the question, and it's about using your iPhone or iPhone integration with your car.
Hey, quick question, if you don't mind passing out to the listeners, is I have to buy a car here by the end of the year for work, and I'm just wondering what people are out there using to really integrate, the iPhone and iOS with Siri into their car. My ultimate goal would be completely wireless, just go walk in the car, and the car automatically recognizes it, and steering control, and you can talk, and, just try and do the safe thing. So just wondering what your listeners are using out there. What's the best setup? The vehicle we'll purchasing will most likely be a brand new model. I know iOS in the car is coming soon, so who knows what that's going to lead to. I appreciate everything you do with the show. I'm an avid listener, and I do enjoy it. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Hey, thanks for the question. So I'm going to throw it out to you. Can you help? What are you using for doing car integration? My thing, I know that we've got Bluetooth integration. That's pretty straightforward. A lot of cars have that functionality built in. I don't know that that's exactly what you're looking for. And you mentioned, the iOS in the car and the Siri's Eyes Free. Those are going to be integrated with iOS 7 and are supposedly coming to some new models, some 2014 models. So I guess if you're buying a new car, maybe you are going to get a 2014 model. As far as the manufacturers that have been announced, a lot of them seem like pretty high-end manufacturers, so I don't know what price range you're looking for a car in, but you've got Acura, Ferrari, Infiniti, Jaguar, Kia, Opel, which I guess is owned by GM, Mercedes-Benz, Nissan, Volvo, Honda, Chevrolet, and Hyundai. Hyundai have all said that they're going to be working with Apple on the iOS in the car stuff. I don't know if that's currently out in certain car models, which models are going to be out. I couldn't find any information on that. Seems pretty limited at this point, which may be what you're running into and why you're asking for our advice. I can tell you what I've done in my car. It's a low-tech solution, but it actually works really well. I use it every day, all the time. And what I have is I have just a mount for my iPhone. I use a thought-out PED 3 Auto from thoughtout.biz. It's just a little gooseneck that I've mounted into the hump in the middle of my car, the one where the stick shift is. And I have that mounted, bolted in, and then that comes up to a mount that I can put my iPod into, and that sits right next to my stereo. And then I connect to my stereo just manually with an 1/8-inch audio cable. So I have an auxiliary in on the front of that, and I plug my iPhone into that, and then I just have a cigarette charger adapter for the lightning cable so that I can USB charge my phone. And so I just pop that in. I have the cables right there. I just have to connect two cables and I'm good to go, because then I just use Siri and the voice commands to pretty much control everything. So if I need to reply to a text, or if I need to control my music, or I need to answer a phone call, I just do that all through Siri. And I just use the mic and speaker that are built right into the iPhone itself. It's up close enough that I've never had a problem with people understanding or hearing me. And I even, my car, the cabin, I have an old 2001 Subaru Impreza, and it's pretty loud. It's not a quiet cabin, and I'm still able to pretty much control and do everything I can. It's not 100% hands-free because I have to reach down and touch the home button, but I don't have to take my eyes off the road. It's just right there. I can reach over and with my thumb just press and hold, get Siri to activate, and then use Siri. And then when I'm talking on a phone call, I just use the speakerphone, do it completely hands-free, and it's really not a problem. So that solution's worked for me really, really well. I know it sounds like you're looking for a little bit more high tech, a little more integrated. That's what I would totally want if I was getting a new car. So those of you out there who can help out, what solutions are you using? Send us some feedback, send us some audio comments, and we'll get a little conversation going about how we do car integration with our iOS devices. And then lastly today, I want to talk about a really new feature of a cool new feature of iOS 7, something that a lot of us are excited about. I know I'm excited about, and that is never having to update your iOS apps ever again, because iOS 7 is going to have this auto update feature that you can turn on, and your iOS apps will just know when there's a new version available on the App Store. They will automatically download, install, and upgrade themselves. You don't have to worry about clicking that update all button or going in and checking. You even get a little push notification to let you know which apps were updated. And it is really, really cool, because when you go into the update list, what it'll show you is which apps were updated, when they were updated. You get a little history that you can scroll through. And that is really, really awesome. But it also in it has a potential problem for disaster, especially if you have older devices and you share those apps between your older devices and your newer devices. Because if a new version of an app comes out and it supports iOS 7 only, you might end up getting your application updated and it could pose a problem. Now, it's not a problem on the device itself, because when you try and upgrade to a new version that's not supported on the device, it'll tell you, it will block you, it won't let you install that on the device. But if you have a newer device and older devices, and then it auto updates that app and you sync back to your Mac via iTunes, iTunes will happily grab that newer version and overwrite the old version that is sitting on your Mac. Same thing if you directly update your apps from iTunes. iTunes doesn't care if the new version of that app is incompatible with your device, because it doesn't really know what devices are going to be connected up, right? You dock in your device and things sync over. And the thing is that this really isn't a problem for your older devices, and you really won't know about it if those devices aren't restored, right? The apps that are on your device are going to stay there. It's not going to try, iTunes will not try and replace the app with a version that's incompatible when you sync and back up and things like that. So the whole thing doesn't seem like a problem until you go to do an erase and restore on your older device. And this whole issue is actually not new. As a matter of fact, it was pointed out to me by a listener, Calum, who had this happen to him with OmniGraffle on his first gen iPad. He had happily had iTunes upgrade the application. So when you go in and look at your apps, it says, hey, new app updates are available. You go ahead and update it. It pulls down new versions of the apps and it puts them into iTunes. The thing was, is OmniGraffle had pushed out an iOS 6 only version of the app. It was the latest update was only compatible with iOS 6 or later, which doesn't run on that first gen iPad. And he was using the first gen iPad with OmniGraffle on there, and it left the old version on there. But when he had to do an erase and restore on that device, guess what? It reloaded all his apps, but OmniGraffle wasn't there. And it was puzzling for a while until he realized that iTunes couldn't put the version of OmniGraffle he had back on his device, and he didn't have an older copy, a copy of the older version. And when he contacted Omni support, rightly so, they said, we don't have that. We can't, we don't have a version that we can give you to install onto that older device. So basically he lost the value of that software. And from the research that I've been able to do, it looks like if you use iCloud backups will attempt to install the last version that you had installed on the device. So that might be a workaround. If you use iTunes backup in the cloud, you might be able to get that old version back, but only as long as the developer has not disabled that version in iTunes Connect. So it doesn't have to be, I think, out and available on the App Store, but if it's been disabled by the developer, that older version, even that one's not going to be able to be pulled back down and put onto your device. And if you're like me, you just use iTunes local backup, and you probably then want to make sure that you store all the old versions or keep backups of the all the old versions of your IPA, the iPhone application files. In my case, that's exactly what I do. I have my iTunes media folder backed up via ChronoSync to my Drobo. And what's cool about the ChronoSync application is that it enables me to set it up where it will sync over everything that I have in my iTunes media folder to my Drobo, make copies. And I do this nightly. And then it will keep all versions in the folder that's on the Drobo. So as I just update in iTunes, even though it's created a new file and it's deleted the older version on my Mac, when ChronoSync goes to run, I have it set up in a way where it will keep an archive. It's a one-way copy, basically. It only copies the newer files. It doesn't remove any deleted files from my Mac from the backup that's on the Drobo. And so I don't sync those deletions. And therefore, when I go over to my Drobo and I look at my backups, I have every version of every app that I've ever downloaded. So that would be a way to work around this potential problem. It's unfortunate, though, because even if you could find a copy of a compatible version that had been replaced on your Mac, you can't just get an IPA file. You can't get the installer file just from a friend or someone else and sideload it because of the restrictions. It's signed with your Apple ID. So you need to have a version that was originally purchased by you. And as a matter of fact, that's Apple's official stance on this issue, is that they tell you to always back up your App Store purchases. That includes applications, that includes movies, that includes your music files, because if those get replaced or removed or something happens on Apple's side, they're not going to be there and available for you to re-download. And that's where this problem is. And I will tell you at this point, all of my evidence is mostly circumstantial, because at this point, only a few people are talking about this issue. I don't know how big of an issue it's going to be with iOS 7, but my gut tells me it's going to be a bigger issue than it's ever been before because of iOS 7 and this auto upgrade ability. I think a lot of people are going to turn it on. As a matter of fact, the Icon Factory did a survey recently, and they found that 52% of developers that they surveyed plan to make the next versions, the next updates of their applications, iOS 7 only. So if you have a device that won't run iOS 7, you have a potential problem in this. Luckily, the auto updates at this point seem to be opt-in, so you actually have to turn on the feature. So my recommendation is, if you're concerned about this, when you upgrade to iOS 7 on your devices that support it, don't turn on the auto update feature. Continue to do it manually so you don't accidentally overwrite iOS 6 compatible version with an iOS 7 only compatible version that might not work with your devices. And I am also concerned, if this feature moves forward, that what happens when it's not just iTunes, it's the Mac App Store that also gets the auto update feature, and suddenly you're not able to re-download compatible versions for your older Macs. So I think Apple has an issue here that they're potentially going to have to address, and I think it's going to come to a head as people start to enable the iOS 7 auto update feature. So I wanted to make you aware of the potential problem, just in case you have older devices that you might be concerned about, so that you can know, start to back up those iOS 6 compatible versions of your apps for your older devices now. Don't wait, go into your iTunes media folder, into the mobile applications folder, and you should be able to see all your applications there. So make sure you're saving off different versions. Whether you use the method that I use, like via a ChronoSync job or some other method, just do it, because I think it's going to be important moving forward. So I wanted to bring that up. But that's the last thing that I have for you for today. Before I leave you completely, I do want to again mention that I have a little project going with Michael Johnston from We Have Communicators. He's been working on this great website called Appler. It's at getappler.com. And it's this great application discovery website. It's social. So what you can do is you can go, you sign up with Appler. It will go out. It will grab all of the applications that you've purchased on the Apple App Store, if you'd like it to, pull those into your account. And then you can review and you can rate those applications. So you can say, I really like this application. I would recommend it to someone. I wouldn't recommend it to someone. And the gist of this was that we found that the way we discovered apps most frequently was through our friends and through other people. We'd say, hey, what apps do you like? Or do you like this app? Would you recommend it? And we get recommendations that way. So this is a site specifically designed to expand that experience online so that you can add friends, add other people that whose advice you trust when it comes to apps, and you can go in and you can look at their recommendations. What are they buying? What are they using? What do they like? And you can share that information back and forth. And so the site's been out in beta for a while. You can go sign up right now. It's free to get an account, and go ahead and follow me on MacCast on there. But we're also looking for some help with improving some of its features. We want to make it more mobile friendly, so make it optimized for iPhones and iPads and things like that. And we could use some programming help. We're looking for PHP, JavaScript, Ajax programmers, specifically people who have an eye for good design. So if you know somebody, or if you're the type of person who would be interested in helping us out, please email me, send me some links with examples to stuff you've worked on, and we'll try and reach out to you. We really would like some help on the project. So if you can do that, please let us know. That'll do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, make sure you check out Text Expander. The new Text Expander Touch 2.0 is available. Go grab that. Also, check out their other software, PDF Pen, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Disk Label. And you can get more information and details on their software, as well as free trials, over at smilesoftware.com. Transporter by Connected Data. You can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. They just came out with their 2.0 software. It's available for everybody now. It greatly improves the functionality of your transporter. And if you'd like to buy a transporter, you can get 10% off personal cloud storage by using the code MACCAST. So just head over to filetransporter.com to check that out and take advantage of that offer. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. Those new gadgets are coming. If you want to get cash for your old iPhone, your iPad, or other Apple products, find out what they're worth at gazelle.com today. And you want to do it quickly, because the prices are going to go down as we get closer to that launch event. You'd be surprised how much you can get for those old devices. And you can lock in your pricing for 30 days. So as we get closer, make sure you lock in your price, and then you can send it in when you get your new device, gazelle.com. And Squarespace, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. You can get a free trial and 10% off by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code MACCAST8. And a big thank you to Squarespace and all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. I look forward to your feedback, your audio comments, your emails. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. Also, be sure to check out the MACCAST forum. There's great advice on there, as you heard in this episode. You should really check it out. That's at forum.maccast.com. Also, get show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. And also, don't forget, we have a Google Plus community. It's MACCAST over there, and pretty much MACCAST every place else, as well as Appler. That's at getappler.com. I look forward to seeing you there. And that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.